I wonder if you ever think to yourself, what does God see when he looks at this world that we live in? Does that thought ever cross your mind? There's a lot of things in the world that when we look at them, we wonder. I found myself in the spring, right before this summer, with about a half an hour of free time between some writing and the meeting I had. And after looking at some emails, I clicked on a news story. You ever do this? It was about a squirrel that surfed. And I watched the video, and that led me to another one. And then within 5 minutes, I was reading news stories that took all of the breath out of my lungs. A mom allegedly killed her 3-year-old daughter. Someone robs a store because they want something so petty and simple that they have that they want to take, and they bring their violence into that place. And one after the other, the stories unfolded, and I found myself dizzy. I had my meeting, I left. On my way home, I couldn't stop wondering, what does God think when he sees this kind of place that we're in? Does God look at it? Does he see it? What does he think about it? You ever think that? I stopped on my way home because I was so distracted by the thought. I needed to call someone. I called a close friend of mine who teaches at a Christian school. I asked him if he ever felt like this. He said he did. He said, yeah, Christian, I sometimes wonder too. What does God think when he sees the world? And we were quiet and there was no easy answer. And then he suggested to me, he said, Christian, when was the last time you read from the prophets? Do you know what the prophets are? Some of you might. In the Old Testament, there are histories, there are writings, there's poetry, there's the Psalms, and there's wisdom. And then there are these books with the names of individuals. We call them the prophets. He said, Christian, you should read there. And the reason he suggested that, it struck me as so appropriate. He said that the prophets weren't just people who told the future. They were people who saw the world and could tell us how it looked to God. That they were, in a sense, men who presented the world in divine focus. The truth is, the news is such a mixture of tragedy and spectacle, of people doing horrendous things to each other and rodents that are surfing, that it's quite clear that the world is really out of focus to us. Would you agree? That we don't know what we're looking at. But there were these men, and they happened to be all men at that time, prophets who looked at the world and who could say with clarity, this is what the world looks like to God. And I started to read over the summer, and I thought, what I'm going to do in this fall, is starting on this Sunday, is week after week, take one of the smaller books. There's major prophets. These are books that are many chapters long. And then there's a collection of 12 that are called the minor prophets. They're short. And I figured what we'll do together with this community gathered is each week starting today, take a look at one prophet. And the first of the minor prophets is someone called Hosea. And take a look, not hoping to summarize the whole book, but with the question in mind, what does the world look like to God? To see if we can't discover something in the prophet way back then that actually is pertinent to the world we live in today. Because the truth is, I'm not interested in just looking way back for the sake of curiosity about how people used to think. The striking thing is, the world hasn't changed that much. Because the way it was back then, in very striking ways, is not too different than the way it is now. Even with all of the tragedies and all of the spectacle that characterize our own time. And if we listen to what God said through old, old prophets like Hosea this morning, I bet we'll hear something that actually helps us. Now that's true for you wherever you are with faith. What I want you to do this morning, each of you, is to listen and to think and to hear some information and then to engage your heart as well. Because what this prophet will do is present a picture of what this God sees when he looks at the world. And then I want you to see what happens in your own heart if this is true. Let me give a little background on Hosea. That's where we'll start. If you have a Bible, I would very much like you to open to the book of Hosea. I had a very compelling sign written on that little cart out there. Please take one today. Did it work for some of you? Okay, great. I want you to look because, listen now, I don't want it to be true that the only time we look at the Bible is when I'm here teaching on Sunday morning. I hope that this practice of opening to obscure passages will teach you to begin on your own reading the Bible, because you can, and you can hear from God as you do. Hosea, in the Bibles that we're handed out there, it begins on page 730. We're going to be looking at a few passages from that book today. Before we get into it, I want to give you the background, a brief picture of the background of Hosea's time, so that you're ready to hear what he has to say. This is a bit of history. Bear with me for a bit. The greatest king in Israel's history, they would say, was the King David. His son Solomon was also a great ruler. But after those two generations, the kingdom of Israel, which was united in the land that was called Canaan, it became divided. And it was broken up into a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. The southern kingdom was called the kingdom of Judah, and the northern kingdom was called the kingdom of Israel. And the southern kingdom, the capital of that city or that kingdom, was the city of Jerusalem. You can still visit that place today. The northern kingdom had a capital city called Samaria. It's not what it was back then, but that's where the northern kingdom was. And Hosea was a man, an ordinary fellow, who lived in the northern kingdom of Israel. He lived sometime in the middle of the 8th century BC, a long time ago. Now, when he lived there, everything was really good. He would have grown up hearing his grandparents talk about the bad old days. Any of you have grandparents who talk about how bad it used to be? Yes, you probably will be one of those grandparents someday. But in Hosea's time, it was profoundly true that things looked good on the outside to people. The king at the time was a man named Jeroboam. He was the second Jeroboam to be a ruler. For generations previous to his rulership, everything was really hard for the people of Israel. You can read about this history in 1st and 2nd Kings or in 1st and 2nd Chronicles. And there you'll read that things for the people in the northern kingdom of Israel were difficult because their neighbors to the north and east were the Assyrians, and they were mean and they made life difficult for them. There was war, and then there was internal strife. People didn't have enough money. There wasn't enough food for the land. Things were very hard. But when Hosea was born, he and his friends lived in a time of peace. If you had asked someone then, how are things in this kingdom? They would say they're good. There were people who were wealthy. They had fortresses that made them feel secure. They had treaties with the Assyrians who lived in the northeast. These people who used to be their enemies had seemed to become their friends. Things politically and socially seemed good in the land. People felt comfortable. And it wasn't only this, but in Hosea's day, if you ask the religious folks, and I want you to know now that this letter, as all of the prophetic letters are, was written not to strangers, but to people who identified themselves as God's own people. If you ask them, how's it going with your religious life? They would have said, good. We put a part of our money and our resources into our temple. We have a fine place to worship. Sundays, although they didn't worship on Sundays, are crowded for us. When the festivals happen and when the feasts are celebrated, our people come together and they remember the good things that God has done. We are doing well. In every way imaginable, the people would have said, we're strong, we're wealthy, we have food, we're building homes, the population is growing, and our religious life is secure. Things are good for us. And that is what the land of Israel looked like when it was put in human focus. People felt good. But now Hosea the prophet. Hosea the prophet will tell us what this world looked like to God. In divine focus, because it looked different. And I put this before us this morning, asking you to pause for a moment and ask first, how does the world look to my own eyes? And then be ready this morning to hear how it looks to God. Hosea in the entire book gives picture after picture of how it looks. I want us to look at chapter 4. And if you have a Bible, flip to chapter 4 now. The beginning verse, the one verse at the beginning of chapter 4, gives us a clear summary of what the Lord sees when he looks at the land where Hosea and his friends live, the land where people thought that things were going well. Let's read verse 1 in chapter 4. Hear the word of the Lord, O people of Israel. For the Lord has an indictment against the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or loyalty and no knowledge of God in the land. In that one verse, he says in a very clear way what God sees when he looks at this place. He begins, Hosea, by saying, hear the word of the Lord. This is important. Hosea is not sharing his own opinion. He doesn't believe he's just saying how it looks to him. He actually is convinced that what he's saying is what God has to say to this group. He speaks for God to them. And what he says is, the Lord has not praise or congratulations or positive words, but an indictment. Do you know what an indictment is? An indictment is a formal charge or an accusation of a serious crime. Hosea says when God looks at the land, he sees something that makes him raise his accusation against you. There's something serious going on and it's criminal. What is it? He says three things. There is no faithfulness, there's no loyalty, and there's no knowledge of God in this land. No loyalty. He doesn't say there's a bit of loyalty, but I want you to add to it. He says there's none. He doesn't say you have some faith, but you need to have a little bit more faith, so let's try to add some more. He says there's no faithfulness. He doesn't say you need to learn more than you currently know about God. He says there's no knowledge of God at all in the land. Can you imagine being a person? Then you'd be surprised. Loyalty and faithfulness and knowledge. These are very important words. To us, they sound a bit different, I'm sure, than they did then. To those folks back then, those three words would have been relationship words. The prophet was saying to those people, you look at yourself and you think you have a relationship with God, but you don't. You think you know him, but you don't know him at all. When God looks at you, he sees a large gathering of strangers. He sees you as strangers, and he knows that you don't see him clearly, but he is a stranger to you. That's what the prophet Hosea says. This is kind of bleak and negative, isn't it? Yes? Now, I know, because I've felt it myself, and I've heard a lot of thoughtful people say it, that one thing we might be tempted to do is to say, hey, listen, this rather glum and negative word, this is in the Old Testament, and since we're Christians, it's the New Testament that really matters. Have you ever heard that line of reason or even felt it? We might say, okay, when it comes to gloominess like this from the Old Testament, I prefer to look to Jesus. He's much more positive. And his message is a message of love and acceptance. When this stuff here becomes too much, I can look to him. Do you know that Jesus Christ himself once said almost the same thing? Do you know this passage in Matthew where folks came to him and he said, someday there will be people who say to me, Lord, Lord, we did all of these things in your name. And then he will say to them, I never knew you. This word from Hosea is not strange. It is a possibility that hangs before all of us. And that is the possibility that we might think we know God, but we don't. And that's what the word from Hosea was to all of those people. And it might be a word that we ourselves need to hear. And so that raises the question, what were they doing that was so bad? What was it about Israel that was so difficult and deadly in those days that the prophet could say, when God looks at you, he says he doesn't know you at all? Out of curiosity, is there someone who's read through the whole book of Hosea and would raise their hand? Some of you have. There are an awful lot of things that are listed that Israel does wrong, aren't there? The book has quite a few specific things that it points out for those people to say, you don't pay attention, but here are the things that are wrong. Now, I'm not going to go through them all with you. There's one in particular. There's one accusation. There's one indictment that God makes against the people that I want us to focus on now. Because it's comprehensive. It sort of holds together the problem for all of those people. I hope that it draws our own attention, not to some people far away, but to ourselves. Because if I had started the sermon and asked you, not what do you think God sees when he looks at the world, but instead, what do you think God sees when he looks at you? I imagine that if you're honest with yourself, some of you would have to admit there must be things about me that are out of order. Not just this world, but me, myself, when I'm alone with my heart. There are things that are not quite right. That was true of these people. It revealed itself in something that appears quite a bit in the book. If you would flip ahead to chapter 11. In this chapter, there is a statement, a clear and concise statement of one of the things that was wrong with these people that comprehended, I think, much of their problem. There's also in this chapter a beautiful image of what God sees when he looks at the world, when he looks at you. I want to start in verse 2 with this one problem that I've alluded to. In verse 2, it says that the people, they offered incense to idols. Do you know what incense is? Do we have any college students here who burn incense in their dorm rooms? Burning incense was a very common practice in Israel, apparently, in these days. And they burned incense before idols, it says. Now, when I first came across this, I thought, could burning incense really be that bad? I didn't burn incense as a college student before an idol. I burned it beside my laundry basket because I never did my laundry. Right? Did anybody else do this? And it smelled nice. And how could that be so wrong? Does that mean I don't know God? Well, of course not. No more than the fact that maybe someone in those days burned incense to make their house smell nice would have been an offense to God. Not at all. That wasn't the issue. But there was something in this practice of offering incense in those days, generations ago, that actually captures something very significant, not outwardly, but inwardly. It's not like this, that God has certain physical acts that just in themselves, like burning incense, are somehow naughty and make you bad on God's list of good or bad. And it's not like that. It's that this action of the people in those days, of offering incense before an idol, it revealed something about the state of their hearts that was very, very distinct and meaningful. It revealed something about their inward disposition that had some very serious implications about their relationship to God that were so profound that it could make it so when God looked at them, he could say, I don't even know these people and they don't know me. There are four things about burning incense before idols that I think that uncover this reality that in those days, those people were behaving as if they didn't know God. I want you to follow me now. Here are four of the things that were revealed about the heart of the person who did this, who burned incense before an idol. First of all, to stand before an idol and to burn incense was to make a sign of reverence. Reverence means to show honor and respect. To state with your actions that I'm in awe of you and you inspire me. Is there anything that you revere like that in the world? A second statement when it came to burning incense was a pledge of allegiance. When the worshiper was there before their idol and they lit their incense, they were saying before that object, I am allied to you. You are the one that I want to be faithful to. I will follow you, and you are the one that I pledge my allegiance to. I trust you, and I want to pledge my faith to you. Is there anything that you do that with in this world? I want you to think. I want you to use your imagination. A third thing, when the worshiper lit up that incense before the deity, they were saying with their action, I desire to please you. I want you to be happy with me. I care deeply about how you feel about me. And this action shows that. Who do you want to please? Who do you want to please deeply? The fourth and final thing that the worshiper said when they lit the incense before this idol was, I put my hope in you. I trust my future into your hands. Do you think we do this ourselves? Put our hope in things? Pledge our allegiance to things? desire to please others around us and revere those things in our world that we're told we must revere? I think if you pause and reflect thoughtfully, you will see that there are many things that present themselves to each one of us as worthy of our reverence. I'm not going to tell you what it is for you, but I want you to think for a moment. I want you to answer these questions in your own heart. Do this internal inventory for a moment. Who do you revere and honor above others? Who is it in your life that takes that place? Where do you pledge your allegiance? Who do you want to please above all others? And where do you place your ultimate hope? For the Israelites in this day, the god called Baal was the one that they were tempted to hope in. The cultures around them had myths about this storm god and fertility god named Baal, who had a war with another god named Mat, and who was brought back to life by a third deity, a woman named Anat. They actually discovered tablets in Syria in 1986 that had this whole story written on it. And living in that land, everyone hoped for rain because it was what was required to make the crops grow. And everyone needed to have a fertile family so that they could have children to work the fields. And so it was very easy in that culture for the people to put their hope in the storm god Baal. And so they burned incense before Baal. And this revealed that they didn't know God at all, the true God. And my friends, there are many, many things that present themselves to us, and they're different at different times in our lives, that promise to give us just what we need to live, that promise to be faithful to us as long as we're faithful to them, that promise to reward us if we'll just sell ourselves out to them, that promise to give us hope and establish us and give us security and future if only we will invest ourselves and pledge our allegiance and show our reverence to them. Here's just a few. If you're in middle school or high school, it's the god of popularity. If you're a young adult, it's the god of beauty, of sexual appeal and attractiveness. And of course, it may be other things, but these are just some that it could be. It could be the god of career success and money. It might be the god of power that comes to you and says, "Bow down and burn your incense before me." It may just be financial security so that you can provide for your family. It may be a good career and a job and a secure future with a home and a happy relational life. It could be almost anything. But all of these gods that come to us and they say, "Pledge your allegiance to me, bow down before me, light up your incense and burn it here." When we do that, what we show, in the same way that the people in Hosea's time showed it, what we show is that we don't know the true God at all. And here's the reason. Because all of those things that make their promises are empty. But the promises of the true God are not empty. They're trustworthy. Every time a person turns their back on God and goes a different direction to pursue the good things that they want to secure for themselves, every time they turn away from God to do that, they hurt themselves. When all the while, if only they would turn back to God, if only they would come to Him and pledge their reverence to Him, give their allegiance to Him, put their hope in Him, and desire only to please Him, do you know that it would be the very best thing for them in their lives to do so? And to know God means to know that He is the one who should be revered because He deserves it and He's trustworthy. He's the one in whom we shall place our hope because He's entirely hopeful. He's the one to whom we can give ourselves because we belong to Him already. We're so confused. We wander about in this world trying to help ourselves and we're like lost little children. And all the while, God looks at us and loves us more than we could ever know. Now, I'm not just making this up. This idea that I've just presented is also what Hosea tells us. This phenomenal prophet doesn't just speak of God looking and seeing bad things, but he goes on to tell us what God sees when he sees us turning away, what God sees when he sees these people burning incense to other gods, and how it feels to him. In fact, what God's heart is like. It's remarkable. This prophet tells us about God's emotions and feelings, which we ourselves stir in him. Do you know that? that you actually make God feel certain things? That God looks at you and it does something to his heart? If this word is to be trusted, that's so. That you move God's heart in a specific way. I want to look at the rest of the chapter 11 here, the rest of chapter 11 with you. In the first verse, Hosea pictures for all who will listen what God sees when he sees these people. Look with me now at verse 1. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. It was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them up in my arms. I led them with cords of human kindness, with bands of love. I was to them like those who lift infants to their cheeks. I bent down to them and I fed them. This is a metaphor. You know what a metaphor is? You know a metaphor? It's a comparison where there are two different things. One of them is lesser known and the other is more known. And the author lifts the part that's more known to teach us about the part that we don't know about. Here, what we know about is what it's like for a parent to care for his child, or for a mom to care for her child in a loving way. You know about that, don't you? Some of you, those of you who are parents, know it best. Those of you who are children, as you enter into the adolescent phase, you'll promptly forget. Those are the parents who are like suffering now because of their children. I want you to think now and just let your mind wander for a moment. The care that a father has when he rescues his son who's in trouble. Have you ever seen a dad rescue a son who's in trouble? If you haven't, just use your imagination. Imagine that you're a father and the son that you love so much is threatened. And it awakens in you the desire to go rescue that child. I myself have had dreams in which my children are threatened by mortal danger, and I run in to rescue them because of the feelings that I have for them. Or imagine you're the father who gets to teach your child to walk, holding up his arms or her hands, saying, "Come this way, one foot in front of the other." Don't you know the joy that a parent feels when he or she sees the child walk for the first time? How moving that is? Or imagine that you're the mom, and you see the infant there, helpless and hopeless, lying in the crib and hungry, begins to cry out. I know this from seeing it with my own wife. Everything in you draws you to that needy little infant because of the love that you feel that is overwhelming, that moves you to do almost anything for that little one. And so you give of yourself, your very body, for that child so that you can nurture it and develop and grow it. You know, the prophet Hosea is teaching us that's how God feels about us. That when God sees us, he sees a beloved son that he wants to teach, a beloved daughter who he wants to nurture and care for and feed and tend to. That when God looks from what seems to us to be far away, it's not for him. He's right there with us, picking us up, holding us, lifting us up to our cheeks. Even as we turn away from God, this is how God feels about us. I want you to take this into your heart now. And if this is the only thing you get from the minor prophet Hosea, it would be a majorly good thing. That when God sees you, he sees a beloved child or daughter who his inclination toward is love, who he means to care for and nurture. And not just when you're good, but in the very moment when you are bowing down before some other false god. That's how God feels about you. Now, in the chapter here, 11, you notice there's some parts that I've darkened out. I skipped over some parts as I read. In verse 2, which I skipped, it tells us what when God looks at us, what he sees not just a child that he loves, but to his dismay, he sees a child who turns away. Verse 2, the more I called them, the more they went from me. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and offering incense to idols. God sees that, and to him, it is like seeing a beloved child who turns away and goes away from his love. And I'm afraid that only a parent who has stood by and watched their child go and abuse their freedom to their own detriment knows what this is like. But I can tell you only from my imagination, time spent with fathers in my office who've talked to me about the pain of watching their children make mistakes and choosing not to interfere and giving them their freedom and watching them hurt themselves, how unbelievably touching and painful this image is. That God looks at us as we turn away and it hurts him. Because we're like children going off on our own to hurt ourselves. Now, what will God do? If you've read through the Old Testament, you've come across some troubling passages. Anyone here read through the whole Old Testament? Some of you have. I was struck one day by a passage, and I think it's in Deuteronomy, in which the procedure for how to deal with a wayward child is described. I heard someone chuckle because you know it, right? Listen, I have to tell you, there are times when I'm reading in the Bible and I just don't know what to do with what I come across. This is one of those times. Okay, get this. Do you remember where it is exactly in Deuteronomy? Someone said 18. It's somewhere in there. Here's the procedure. If a child is wayward, if a child is disobedient to his parents and won't do what his parents say, they should reprimand him and discipline him. But if he continues in his disobedience, if he keeps going away from the father, this is what shall happen. They shall take that child to the edge of the town, to the gates. All of the elders shall gather together. They shall pick up stones, and they shall stone that child to death in front of all the people who watch, to set an example for everyone and to strike fear into their hearts. Is that unsettling to you? Yes? Can you imagine? I mean, this is what the procedure was. I don't know if they did it often, but I do know that in the ears of the people who are hearing this image here, they all knew that in our own law, it says, if a child behaves like this, God has sanctioned the harshest of all punishments. And so Hosea's readers, as they hear this image, you, when you turn away to other gods, are like a wayward child. They might be wondering, will we read next that God is going to take us and destroy us utterly? Because in their minds, they would have thought, by our own law, maybe that's what God should do. Maybe he should give up on us. And I want to share with you now, this is a confession, that there are times when I'm looking at the news, when I'm reading about what this world is like, when I see what people do to each other, I wonder, has God given up on us? Have we gotten so bad because maybe he's decided to just let us go altogether? Has that thought ever crossed your mind? Here's what Hosea goes on to say in the 11th chapter. Find your way to verse 5, and here's what he writes. God, looking at this wayward son, says, they shall return to the land of Egypt. That is, I'm going to let them go back to where they used to be in bondage. I'm going to give up on them, God says. And Assyria shall be their king. Assyria was the foreign power. Because they have refused to return to me. It's as if God is saying, they've turned away so many times, I'm ready. I'm this close to giving up. The sword rages in their cities. It consumes their oracle priests and devours because of their schemes. My people are bent on turning away from me. To the Most High they call, but he does not raise them up at all. Things are so bad because they keep turning away. They've turned away from me, and that's why it's so miserable. There's violence. There's cruelty. There's oppression. There's no justice because they've wandered far away, and that's how it is. Maybe I should give up, God says here. And if that were the end of the chapter, it would be dismal. Then I would have to end this first sermon in the series on the minor prophets and say, when God looks at the world, he sees a group of people who he loved but have turned away, and who knows what's going to happen. But that's not the end of the chapter. It's not the end of this image. God, the loving parent, looks at this situation and in verse 8 goes on to ask this question. How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? Ephraim is another word for Israel. God looks at the people he loves, the people who have turned away from him, and he thinks about giving them up, and he says, how could I do that? How could I hand them over? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? Those were two cities that had been totally destroyed. God asks the question, how could I ever destroy them? And then he says this. The prophet shows us what God's heart does. My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and no mortal, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come in wrath. I am God and no mortal means maybe a father would finally give up, but that's not who I am. Maybe a dad who had a son who turned away this many times would finally throw in the towel, but I'm not like that. I'm God and no mortal. And when I look at these people and see the pain that they bring on themselves, and I think about letting them go, my heart recoils within me. That means when God looks at us, if we want to have a picture of what not just the world looks like in divine focus, but what we ourselves look like in God's eyes, he loves us so much that his heart recoils within him when he thinks of our misery. And the thought of letting us go makes his compassion grow warm. The God of the prophets that they speak of, that we're going to meet week after week from now until we're done with this series, this God does not take evil and wickedness lightly. He hates it. He hates injustice. He hates oppression. He hates when the poor people are exploited by the rich. He hates when those who are weak are oppressed by the strong. We're going to see this over and over again. He's not an easy God because he hates injustice. But at the same time, this God is a lover of people. A lover like a mom loves her infant. A lover like a dad loves his son. A lover who loves you and me more than we would dare hope or imagine. When we look at this world and we see it in our own focus, we can't even believe it. But in divine focus, Hosea teaches us that we look like beloved children of God who he is unwilling to give up on. That's a pretty good message from Hosea, isn't it? What shall we do? Well, if you have a Bible there, flip to the end of the book, to chapter 14. I want to read some words there, and then I'm going to break bread, and we're going to share communion together. In chapter 14, Hosea says these words, "Return, O Israel, to the Lord your God." Come back. That's what we should do. If we've turned away to burn incense before some other god, Hosea says quite simply, just come back. "You've stumbled because of your iniquity. Take these words with you," he says. If you want to know what to say to God, here it is. "Take away my guilt." Not, "Hey, listen, let me explain why I messed up. Let me tell you why I did things wrong." No, no. He says, you start by just saying this to God. "Take away my guilt." Just take it away. You don't need to carry it anymore. You weren't meant to. "Accept that which is good, and we will offer the fruit of our lips. We will tell you that we trust in you. Assyria shall not save us. We will not ride upon horses. We will say no more, 'Our God,' to the work of our hands. In you, the orphan finds mercy." And then listen to the promise that God gives. "I will heal their disloyalty." That means God himself will set things straight. I love this line. This is God speaking. "I will love them freely. For my anger has turned from them, I will be like the dew to Israel. He shall blossom like the lily. He shall strike root like the forests of Lebanon." God himself is ready for you to turn and come back. He's ready for you to simply ask, "Take my guilt away." And then he's ready to heal you. To heal you from your iniquity. Not that you would straighten yourself out, but that the God we worship is the one who comes to us and straightens us out. Now, how did he do it? The table here before me is the most profound and simple picture of how God has done what he said he would do. And that is in the bread, which Jesus himself took at the last meal that he had with his disciples. The bread was broken by Jesus as he said, "This is my body broken for you." And then he showed it to his disciples and he said, "You take this and you eat." In the Gospel of John, he spoke about the bread as his own body. And so what we will do now is that we will come forward, those of us who are ready to say, "Take away my guilt, forgive me as I return to you." We will take this bread knowing that Jesus Christ has given himself for us. And as close as this bread is to our mouths, so close is he to us as we come to him. And then just as I take this pitcher and pour it out, Jesus himself took a pitcher and he poured it before his disciples on that last evening in that meal. And he said, "This cup is the new promise sealed in my blood, the promise that I will be your God and you will be my people. It's poured out for the forgiveness of sins. And that's what we need. We need more than anything else to have our sins forgiven. And on that night, Jesus poured the cup just as I have here. And he told those disciples to take it and eat, and as they did it, to remember him. Now this morning, we gathered in his name and in his presence have the simple privilege to come to this table because he is so good. Because he is a father who will never give up on us. And as I ask my helpers to come forward, Matt has invited four of you to come help me. If you'd come forward now, we're going to break bread. Each of us will come and tear a piece off and dip it in either the juice, which is in these smaller cups, or the wine, which is in the bigger. And then take that and eat it and know that so close as the bread and wine is to your mouth, that's how close Jesus Christ is to you, who gave himself for you and loves you. We're going to begin on this side over here to come forward. And there'll be folks in the middle here. And after that, we'll come forward on this side. I'm going to ask the musicians to come forward also. And if two of you would serve them as I pray. And then we'll prepare our hearts to take this meal. Let's pray together. God, in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, we offer you great thanks. Thanks for the gift of life and the gift of yourself. We praise you that you would give yourself for us, wayward sons and daughters, that you would come so far as to die on a cross to recover what is yours. We thank you that your heart toward us is love, that you desire so deeply to be in fellowship with us that you would give yourself. I pray now as we take this ordinary bread and this ordinary wine or juice, that you would transform these elements and feed our souls upon your very self. Unto eternal life, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. And come forward now as the meal is prepared.